In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 21st day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Interesting tidbit on how this city works for those who may not be familiar. When there's bad weather coming, as there was here in Washington yesterday, a lot of companies and a lot of the big international agencies that are based here take their cue on whether or not to be open for business from the federal government, the Office of Personnel Management specifically. So when OPM decided yesterday was going to be a snow day, so too did the powers that be at the International Monetary Fund, which is a long way of saying our interview with the IMF's managing director, Christine Lagarde, which was supposed to air yesterday, didn't even happen until a couple of hours ago, so you're going to get it today. Lagarde has been at the IMF since 2011. She's running the main global agency focused on maintaining stability in the worldwide economy. And we started with a perspective question. You've been at the highest levels of global economic policy for a long time now, both in France and now here at the IMF. Describe this moment for me, would you? Because it's an interesting time for multilateralism in the global economy.
You know, it's a strange moment because it's one where we still see growth, but we're seeing major risks on the horizon that could undermine current growth position.
Say more on the risks you see.
The three categories of risks. Risk number one, the tensions that we are seeing in international trade, particularly between U.S. and China. Mm-hmm. The second cloud on the horizon, second risk, is the financial risks, where we are currently in a position where many countries, many corporates, many households mm-hmm. are heavily indebted. Mm-hmm. The third risk is that of an accelerated slowdown of growth in China. And then you have some related risks, such as uncertainty of the outcome of Brexit and any geopolitical risk that we have around.
Well, so to that subject of geopolitical risk and more specifically the role of the United States in the global economy today, you are dealing with an administration that is, if not openly hostile, then deeply skeptical of what you and this organization and the World Bank and many other multilateral institutions do. How do you deal with that as a woman whose job it is to promote multilateralism? I mean, that's your thing now, the new multilateralism.
You know, I tell you, it is not the case that the Treasury Department, with whom we have a relationship because mm-hmm. the Treasury is representing the United States at the board of the IMF, so it is not the case that we have a bad relationship. We actually have a good relationship with the Treasury Department, and I'm still to see a situation, a case, a country where we work, where we are engaged, and where the U.S. authorities at whichever level will say, we're not happy with what you do. We really do not support the institution. I have seen, like, in the case of Egypt, in the case of Ukraine, in the case of Jordan, in the case of Argentina, significant engagement on the part of the U.S. authorities to support the work that we do in those countries.
You know, this is interesting because you're being very positive in your outlook for multilateralism. But you wrote in a blog post, first of all, you're a blogger at the IMF website. you wrote a blog post last November called When History Rhymes. Mm-hmm. And you hearkened back to the First World War mm-hmm. in 1918 and the rise of inequality and the conflict and all of the horrible things, actually, that happened around that time. And you say, if we're not careful, we're looking at that again. Reconcile what you just said with what you wrote in November for me.
I think those threats are there. And certainly what we are seeing in many countries, predominantly advanced economies, is this sentiment that globalization, new technologies are a threat, are going to take your job, are taking you out of control of your destiny. That's what a lot of people perceive.
There are millions of people in the United States who believe that.
Yeah. No. And, you know, it's not specific to the United
True.
States.
True.
You know, movement in my country, France, like the Yellow Vest, is also an expression of this anxiety about the future. But this is not going to be solved appropriately by turning inwards, by looking at your belly button. It's going to be addressed by looking at the size of the problems, the nature of the threats, how it can be addressed, and cooperation between countries. But what is domestic and what is critically important is to make sure that there is in place the protection, the adjustment mechanisms so that people feel that they have control over their destiny. People feel that it's going to pay back for them as well, and that it's not because there is more robots, more digitalization, more artificial intelligence applied to their work site and their workplace that they're going to lose out. That's where domestic policies meet international cooperation, if you will.
What do you make, then, of the trade negotiations that are happening now between China and the United States? Do we make too much of that? Should we just bank on them being solved?
I cross my fingers every morning and my toes every evening because I hope that it is going to end up with a way to fix the system, not break it. Because I do believe that the system needs fixing. There has to be some realism applied to the trade relationship. And I think that that is the great benefit of what is happening at the moment. So if the outcome of the discussions between the US trade team and the China trade team leads all of us in the direction of an improved framework where subsidies are well defined, where state-owned enterprises are well defined, where intellectual property is protected, then this is really an improvement.
Grade yourself for me, would you? You've been on this job now going on 8 years, right? You got a couple of years left. How are you doing so far?
You know, I might even have a third term. Why not?
We'll see how this interview goes. I don't know. People are listening.
It's not for me to say.
Well,
The fact that the membership decided to reappoint me for a second term unanimously, I took that as a token of appreciation and recognition of the effort that I put in every morning and the focus that I have on delivering on the mission.
Here's a better way to ask the question, and I should have done this the first time. You came on this job in 2011. The world and certainly the American economy barely climbing out of the Great Recession. Have you been able to do what you wanted to do when you took the job?
You know, when I took the job, I was, and everybody else was, under the impression that the situation was improving significantly and that we were out of the great financial crisis. Yeah. And then suddenly the European sovereign debt hit our radar screen and we were back into the saddle of addressing those issues and putting, you know, more programs in place in order to help countries around the world. So my job, as I said, is a bit like being a mixture of an architect helping frame policies, focusing on what is macro critical, including unusual subjects like participation of women in the workplace, reducing excessive inequalities, fighting corruptions, and being a firefighter whenever there is a crisis on the horizon and a country knocks at the door to say, I can't refinance myself. I'm in real trouble and where I have to help.
So we are here 10 years plus or minus after the crisis. And I want to ask you about something you said early in your tenure at the IMF, that if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Sisters, crisis either would have been different or might not have happened at all. Mm-hmm. Elaborate on that now, sitting here in 2019.
Okay, a few years later, what has changed for me is that the IMF now recognizes that the role of women in the economy can be macro critical and therefore warrants our focus, our attention, our research capacity, and our policy recommendations. What we have done very recently, I just want to mention two numbers for you, is a thorough study on the banking sector to see how many women were in executive boards or boards. 20% only are women. How many women are CEOs or chairmen of banks? 2%.
Yeah.
And then we tried to correlate the solidity of banks with the number of women sitting on the board. And it's very interesting to see that those banks which have a significant number of women on their board are stronger, are less likely to file for insolvency, have bigger capital buffers, have less non-performing loans, and are less risky. Interesting, isn't it?
No, it's totally fascinating. And I will share another anecdote with you. We have just come from an interview with Janet Yellen, former Fed chair. She said to say hi, by the way.
Reciprocated.
We're going to air that on Monday. My producer and I were chit-chatting with some of your staff before this interview. And we said, you know, it's really interesting. When you get those big group pictures of international economic meetings, you have a whole bunch of guys, and it used to be just Christine Lagarde and Janet Yellen.
It's raining men.
And you have that picture now, and it's just you.
I miss Janet.
Yeah.
I do. You know, I'm doing my best in my own capacity to encourage and support women, because I think that they are huge contributors. They can bring a lot to the table. And in this institution, for the first time, I was privileged to appoint a chief economist who is a woman.
Right. Just recently.
Geeta Gopinath,
right?
Yeah. Just recently. And I will keep at it. But I think that the economic professions, particularly the macroeconomic professions, has a serious shortfall in women. And it's time that the economists actually look at it themselves. And I trust that Janet, in her position, will do that too.
We had that actual conversation about her role as president of the AEA in 2020.
Yeah.
Well, Christine Lagarde, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.